Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to another edition of On the Continent, your one-stop shop for everything to do with European football. I'm Dotton Adebayo.
And I'm Miguel Delaney.
And I'm Lars Watson.
On today's programme, which of the 2 English teams left in the draw is more likely to make it to the Champions League final, Chelsea or Man City? Did Bayern suck the best out of PSG? Do Chelsea have the freshest legs in the tournament, having rolled over Porto without busting a bead? And what difference will that make if the real Madrid turn up to Stamford Bridge? Also, with 2 state-sponsored clubs left in the draw, is the PSG model the future of football or a flag of convenience? And has the peach of the goals, in my opinion, in the quarters, made Gareth Southgate's mind up as to who gets to go to the Euros? So, first things first, Andy Brassel, the top brass, is not with us today, but it's a delight to have both Lars and Miguel with us. Thank you both for agreeing to come in and to bail the old Brassel out, as it were. We've got a lot to talk about, though. Miguel, first of all, this I think it was a cracking series of games that were the quarterfinals of the Champions League. And we have to look at, first of all, Dortmund losing to Manchester City. A lot to talk about around that, not least to talk about their star striker as well. What did you make of the match?
I mean, Dortmund gave a good account of themselves, but it was always, especially when they're 1-0 up, it felt like they were pushing themselves to the very limits of their capability and form this season. And that's also why it felt like this was more... For City, it wasn't quite a battle against Dortmund. It was a battle against themselves and their own neuroses of the Champions League. Because you could kind of see the panic in their play before they got what was quite a fortuitous penalty from a kind of a mad Emre Can decision. And then as well as that, the transformation, especially once they got the second goal. And it's why it was, I think, a hugely significant win for City in terms of kind of going for this Champions League. And that's nothing to do down Dortmund, but they obviously had a lot of problems this season. And ultimately, they were kind of borne out in the way in when the tie went.
I suppose, Lars, the way that you saw Phil Foden celebrate his goal with Pep Guardiola, you knew what it meant for them. Are Man City out of the quarterfinal hoodoo now, then, of the Champions League?
I think it will have meant a lot to them psychologically. I'm a big skeptic of the concept of hoodoos, but I think with Guardiola, you can't deny that there is a mental side of this. And he referenced in an interview recently the sort of that they're all human beings in the end, and you can do everything perfectly according to your plan, but if those shots don't go in, then what can you do?
You could see in the celebrations.
Yeah, and that's always been the thing with Guardiola. His whole football is about trying to control the intangibles, about trying to, you know, lessen the number of random incidents that can hurt you in the game, of controlling as much as possible. But still in these games, the random incidents have tended to hurt them. And of course, it's a huge deal for them that they didn't this time. But it's entirely logical when they dominate these games as much as they do. You can say, yeah, it's a daft penalty for Emre Can to give away and the goal was a bit of a mistake by the goalkeeper, but these are the things that should logically happen when you spend as much time in the opposition box as City do. So this is how this game should have gone. But yeah, the mental side of it, you have to acknowledge that was a big thing.
Talking of random things that can happen to you in the middle of a game, though, it's Dortmund that should be looking at that because, according to you, Blash, they've been playing rubbish all season.
Well, rubbish is not the word, but they're a ludicrous team, really, because I've said they've been largely ludicrous this season, was my word in the group chat, because every single Dortmund game you watch, they'll do something good going forward because they have so many attacking players who are super exciting, but they do so many ridiculous things defensively. And my favorite example recently was the Stuttgart game at the weekend when they have an attacking throw-in way up in deep into Stuttgart's half. Throwing gets taken and there's one bad pass and suddenly you have four Stuttgart players in on goal because like half of Dortmund's defense have just ran off for no reason. I mean, they do so many bizarre things defensively. And they've done that throughout the season. And I just never... I knew they'd score against Man City because I think they've scored in something like 27 out of 28 games in the league. I mean, they almost always score. But you can... You wouldn't trust that defence to keep Man City out under any circumstance.
Yeah, it would have been stretching credulity for them to keep a clean sheet in that game. But I do want to just pick up on something you said there. I mean, obviously they have Mats Hummels, but then he's always been kind of good for an error, to be honest, despite how good he is a defender. Yeah. But I do wonder whether... some of that is a product of when your team just has so many young players in it that there isn't basically the more experienced heads to offer a bit more composure.
I agree, but you also have to look at some of the experienced heads that are... You bring in someone like Emre Can because you're hoping he'll, you know, bring some calmness to proceedings.
He's only 26, 27. Well,
yeah,
he?
But he's been around at the top level for a long time.
Forever.
And he's just not really done that. And I think Axel Witsel is a big miss for them as someone who's got a bit of a footballing head on his shoulders. He's obviously out with injury for a long time. But I also think Hummels is a good defender, but I think he needs some legs around him for it to work really well. And you look at someone like Akanji who hasn't developed quite the way you'd hoped. And just, they don't seem that well organized. I mean, I think at some point it goes to... At some point you have to look at the coaching and the culture of the club a little bit as well when there's these sort of mental sort of breakdowns that seem to happen defensively. Quite even in the first game, the Manchester City's winning goal, like the context is they have this great 1-1 result at Manchester in the bag right towards the end of the game. And even in that situation, City are allowed to have a 2-on-1 on the back post because none of the defenders has clocked on to the fact that there's an extra City player there and you need to move in. There's not the defensive sort of mindset, I think.
And yeah.
I think the idea was to bring in Hummels to help change that because he's a leader, he's a vocal guy. But it hasn't worked. I mean, they're still a nonsensical team defensively so often. And I guess that's the big one of the big jobs that Marco Rosa has when he's coming in and taking over.
I suppose that's the thing as well. I mean, when there are plenty of examples, like with Chelsea being the main one, of a club bringing in a stand-in manager who ends up winning the Champions League. But that's probably only possible at a super club. When you're a club of Dortmund, who are kind of a tier or two down from a club like Manchester City in resources, it's stretching a bit to kind of be, try and overcome form and overcome kind of what you are as well in a game like that. Eventually, kind of reality will intercede.
And it might be a little bit to do with the characters you have in the dressing room. I think this is a team that, as much as they're fun to watch, you're probably not wrong about there just being too many young players. I mean, if you're in a situation where you have sort of four or five of them almost in your lineup, maybe that's too many.
What is it? I mean, and even like if we think of the kind of the great young teams of the past, like the classic kind of youth oriented Ajax, they had Rijkaard and Danny Blind. I mean, you can't get too, and even like the De Boers are that bit older. Manchester United, the mid-90s, they had, what, Cantona, Schmeichel, Pallister, Bruce, and even Keane, who's never been a young player, really, in any sort of mental sense.
I'm not a sort of big-brain tactical analyst by any means, but I do find watching Dortmund quite regularly, as I do, I very often just find myself shouting at the TV, like, what are you doing? Like, where have you gone off to? Like, why is this in the centre half? Where is the right back gone? Like, there's just so many weird, odd things you see from the defence. And I think, all in all, I thought they conducted themselves better in... I thought they were going to get a hiding in one of these two legs. I thought they did a bit better than I was expecting.
But that's why I think the game was ultimately about City beating a battle against themselves rather than Dortmund.
Yeah.
Because by any sort of logic, really, City should have won that quite comfortably, which they did once they got ahead. But when it was in the balance, it felt like City's own kind of neuroses about this competition were more influential than maybe what Dortmund did. And Dortmund exploited that for a time.
It was Dortmund's younger players that caught the eye.
Yeah,
not least of the spectators, but also I suspect of the England manager when it comes to Jude Bellingham. And, you know, what a great goal he scored. So even though it's not the finished product, they're an exciting team, or should be an exciting team to watch.
Yeah, I mean, watching some of the coverage, I'm very tempted to put on my hipster hat and go, oh, wow, you've discovered that Jude Bellingham is good.
I interviewed him in October.
This is the thing. And in fairness to anyone who we want to accuse of being reactionary here, it is different doing it against Augsburg in the Bundesliga and doing it in a Champions League quarterfinal. Like, it does put you on a slightly different in terms of how ready you are. But he is a remarkable player. And first, the obvious thing, he doesn't look 17. Like, you watch him play, neither physically or with the calmness he has and the confidence he has.
He's got a football brain.
Yeah.
And at 17,
If you even look at what type of player he is, he's got an unusual skill set because he's both someone who's a reliable ball winner. Like, he can put in a challenge and he can muscle people off the ball and win the ball. But he's also really good at driving it forwards. Like, so midfielders who are both pretty solid, chunky, you know, who win challenges but also transports the ball forwards on the pitch.
Yeah.
There aren't too many of them around. Like, it's a very rare skill set he's got.
I think he's England's most complete midfielder, but that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
Just as a slight tangent there, you mentioned Augsburg. I've heard that term, that club a lot in these sort of discussions, and I do wonder, are Augsburg now to portray the forgiving nature of the Bundesliga, are they what Stoke were to display the supposed awkwardness of the Premier League?
I think they're just my go-to team because it's the one that I have few that means the least. I don't remember any time you were worried about playing against Augsburg. Maybe Schalke should be the one we make fun of this season.
Well, Schalke are traditionally big. It just recalls the famous comment from Roy Keane to Yap Sam without curse, actually. I mean, I'm quoting someone, so I should. You're not playing fucking Willem Twey now.
But this is the thing, and I think that with Bellingham, it does matter that he's done it in these games and been really good against Man City. It's not just because it was on the telly and a lot of people watched it. It matters because you've shown that against top quality opposition.
Exactly. It's a Champions League quarterfinal. Yeah. There's no getting away from that.
Yeah, and I think, as much as I was, when you see people have their sort of England draft squads for the Euros and Sancho's not in it, like, obviously I want to tear my hair out, like, because he's very obviously one of your best players. In fairness to them, he hasn't always looked great for England.
Yeah.
And maybe it doesn't help his cause that he's absent for games like this. I don't know.
It's a very important point that you made, though. If a young player can do the business in a really important match like this, quarterfinals of the Champions League, and the thing that impressed me with the Jude Bellingham goal was that he used the opposition defender, to mask his shot. Otherwise, the goalie met, because the goalie almost got it, you know. Otherwise, Agodi may have reacted a fraction of a moment sooner and actually gotten to the ball. But anyway, Miguel has nailed his mask firmly to the colour. Miguel has clearly nailed his colours clearly to the mask by saying Jude Bellingham...
Should never nail your mask to the colour.
Well, no, you can do it both ways. Yeah, but it's a harder prospect in that respect. But he's saying that Jude... Essentially, aren't you, Miguel, saying that Jude Bellingham needs to be on that in that squad to the Euros?
As expected, Bellingham will be in the squad.
He will be, And you agree with that? He should be in the squad?
Yeah, no, completely. Okay. Absolutely agree.
I'm just checking. What about the way that Pep Guardiola was in this match? Usually you get the feeling that he is the chess master, as it were, Miguel, that he is controlling every single aspect of the game. You can see him on the touchline. No, move forward 1 inch. No, move back 1 inch. He's always micromanaging his team. But here in this match, it seemed like he'd given them a little bit more scope to play.
I thought he was frantic for a lot of the game. Like, frantic. And Guardiola... certain managers who, no matter what, are kind of zen-like or just always the same pose line. You can read exactly the way a game is going from how Guardiola is in the sideline. Mm. I mean, I WhatsApp a few kind of friends last night when they were 1-0 down and looked really bad for City at halftime. I wonder what Guardiola's halftime team talk is going to be like. And someone responded basically, oh, probably a lot of grabbing players by the side of the head and shouting at them. he was frantic.
Nose to nose, tip of the nose to tip of the nose.
And then again, once they got ahead, suddenly that calm in his demeanour. And I think that, again, that just shows... Not just what this meant to the club, which is obviously one side of it, but what the Champions League means to Guardiola. It's something we've brought up on the pod before. But I do think, and it's all the more remarkable given he won it twice in his first three seasons, but I think he does have a huge complex about it. I think that is tied to the fact that he was a Barcelona supporter growing up, obviously, but at a time when Barcelona had never won it, when they suffered some ludicrous chokes in the competition that were have been reminiscent of some of his own recent history, and when it was a trophy exclusively associated in Spain with Real Madrid. I think they were the only team to club to win it at that point. Mm. And because of all that, I think the longer he's gone without winning it, the more it's become a thing for him, and the more he's kind of made some of these unexpected decisions in it that are almost kind of, you know, classic law of unintended consequences stuff. And I think genuinely this means more to him than it does to the club, even though the club are desperate to get on that platform.
In the week that, certainly in England, the coronavirus restrictions was lifted with regards to unessential shops and so on, I get the feeling that this match, of all the matches of the quarterfinals of the Champions League, was something of a shop window, particularly for... You know, the football directors of these clubs looking ahead to the summer when they're going to be doing their business and so on, particularly with Haaland. I don't think we got as good a look of Haaland here in England in the first leg of this quarterfinal as we did in this second leg, though. He is a Norwegian genius, as you've said,
of course,
countless of times,
Lars. Many times.
Yeah, but where's he going?
I'm just taken aback by you calling Dortmund a non-essential shop. I mean, that's a dig.
I was talking about
the non-essential shop of football. but you're right. I think, obviously, much has and will be made of the fact that he's gone a few games without scoring now, which we're not used to seeing from him. And one of the things I quite like about him as a viewer is that he's quite honest with his emotions on the field. Like, he doesn't do much to hide how he's feeling, which I think is fine, but it maybe becomes an issue when the overwhelming emotion he's transmitting is frustration. He is a little bit frustrated at the moment.
There's a bit of Cristiano there about that, isn't there?
For sure. There's a lot of Cristiano about the whole guy, really. And I think that jars a little bit with the sort of jet-setting ways of his agent and father at the moment. If you're a Dortmund fan, maybe that's not what you want to see. I think, I mean, you've done a good piece on this, Miguel. A lot of his goals so far in his careers have been from tap-ins, from close by. And he's someone who, as much as we see him as this big, strong force of nature, and he can score good individual goals, the majority of his goals come after good team play. And it's his movement in the box that stands out more than anything. And the fact that Dortmund aren't quite at their best at the moment, that impacts him. Because if he's not getting that kind of service, I mean, I joked on social media the other day that, you know, he hasn't scored in a few games, but the last time I saw a Norwegian receive such poor service was the last time I was in a mid-range restaurant in Budapest. which is a bit mean, but, you know, it's true. And I think Haaland is a player who thrives off of service, and he's still making runs, he's still making himself available, but the ball didn't come to him.
Yeah, but, I mean, the thing about that, I mean, just as we discussed this, what I'm thinking is, you could actually understand Haaland's mindset here in that a player of his talent shouldn't be out of the Champions League for any extended period of time. And it's why, for all the talk of a Super League, it's why there is almost one by design, because any top player, any player of worth, they just can't countenance a single season outside of it. And it's why, ultimately, I mean, it's a product of a football system and it's unfair, but it's why it justifies his decision to want to leave now and as soon as possible. And it, why he'll probably go this summer.
Yeah, although the Dortmund suit, you know, top chief exec or whatever, says that they don't have to sell any of their players.
Yeah, but I think
they say that, but it's not true.
They
really do.
And it's also, it's not necessarily down to them, because Haaland sits at the very center of something of a potential transfer merry-go-round this season.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, basically, yeah, you're right. It's where he goes, or what he does, his decision will dictate the entire summer. Because basically, obviously, there are a score of clubs in from primarily Real Madrid and Manchester City, with Barcelona a bit behind that. But ultimately, if they manage to get the finance together, I think that would be a surprise. Manchester United obviously have long-standing interest, but I'm told they have no chance of signing him for all sorts of reasons. And I suppose, but the thing about it is, whoever doesn't get Haaland, Chelsea, actually, I should mention, are interested as well and have some chance, I'm told. But whoever doesn't get Haaland, it's not just about them wanting a striker, but it's also about, I suppose, the arms race. And that if, say, whichever club gets him suddenly have supercharged their chances of doing something next season. So then it's about trying to match that. So there's obviously the obvious knock-on effect in that whoever Haaland picks, their rivals then have to go for somewhere else, which will bring, I suppose, Harry Kane into play. Then there's Kylian Mbappe as well. And so the entire summer, and also because of the fee involved and the knock-on effect of that as well, the financial effect, because basically if Haaland didn't move, it would mean there isn't that much financial movement in the market, which would mean, I think, it'd be a much more subdued window. But if he does move, it just creates this there's so many effects from it. Everything hinges on his decision, basically.
Yeah, so I've always... looking at this, it's an intriguing situation. So I'm very, very certain that their plan was not to move this summer. I mean, he's somewhere where he is playing all the time, where he's the focal point of the team. He's developing well. I mean, we mentioned he hasn't scored in these two legs, but he's provided a very good assist in the first one, and he held up the ball very well for the goal in the second leg, and he's doing things he wasn't doing a year ago. So he's developing very nicely as a player. But he has said this, he wants to play in the Champions League every year of his career. And the thing about Dortmund missing out on the Champions League is not just that they're not playing in it, it's what it means in terms of they have to sell players. So for him, it's the prospect of spending a year at a club with a new manager who's rebuilding. And that's a bit of a risk to take for him, even though the transfer clause means he has more options next summer, probably. And he would probably get a better deal financially if he waited a year, because next summer you can go, my transfer fee is being artificially deflated by this clause, so I can ask for more money. I mean, that's kind of how it works. But I think for sporting reasons, he might want to move this summer. Yeah. I think that is being brought up. And to my mind, I always imagined that City is the only logical destination then, because I struggle to see how the other ones can get the money, but Real Madrid are funny like that. They tend to find ways of getting the money.
Well, from that perspective, I mean, Madrid, the way it's been explained to me, basically, is that, I mean, Florentino Perez, he can go to almost any bank in Spain, explain that signing big stars is absolutely crucial to Real Madrid's business model, so it's a sensible decision to open a credit line, and that's how they're able to afford it. And especially because of the situation, because of the clause next season, Dortmund aren't quite in the perfect bargaining position that they were, say, last season with Jadon Sancho. I still think it's going to be Madrid. And also, the other side of that is, I mean, there's two elements there. From what I've spoken to people about, I think they want a little bit of a nomadic career, that they want him to play in different leagues, a bit like Cristiano Ronaldo. And also, they want a long-lasting career. And the thinking is, if they go to the Premier League too soon, because of the intensity, the schedule, that might affect him physically. And he's a player that picks up a lot of little muscle injuries.
Yeah, so you can see that because he's a muscular guy, you know.
Yeah.
So he uses that.
It could suit to go to Spain earlier. Yeah. And then, of course, the other thing is City are very, then the way they have positioned themselves because of their clout, they're very much not a selling club. So if you go to City now, you're probably there for 8 years.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I'd throw into the mix as well is that he has a brother who basically had to give up on a serious football career at a young age because he picked up so many injuries that he couldn't, you know, get going with it. So maybe that's something they worry about a little bit more than I think other young stars probably worry about. I think that's a fair shout. I also feel he just seems like a better match for Real Madrid than Man City. I can see where he would fit in footballing-wise in terms of all the chances City create and having another striker who can just focus on scoring. And I think much has been made about Pep playing without a forward. I don't think that's an issue for them, but I do feel sometimes this team is prone to coasting a little bit. You know, in the first game against Dortmund, you sense that they were so much in control that it's almost like sometimes there are games where they're so much in control, they almost forget that they have to actually score the goals.
Yeah.
And I think having someone like Haaland, who's just a single-minded guy who doesn't care about all these pretty passes, he wants to score as many goals as possible, I think that would be very good for this City team. But I'm not sure that's what Pep Guardiola wants. And I think when you have your pick of all the clubs in the world, going to a place where you're not entirely certain if the coach has you as his number one choice is maybe not ideal. And I just think mentality-wise, his sort of complete single-mindedness, I think, fits Real Madrid very well. Yeah. The whole culture of that club, I think he adds something they've missed a little bit since Cristiano Ronaldo went, even though Benzema's been playing really well. But someone who is that, you know, completely focused on scoring goals and doing that, I think I can just see it fitting really well.
Tonight you became the youngest player in UEFA Champions League history to score a first-half hat-trick. How are you feeling right now?
I feel very good.
What's the secret? 17 goals now this season in 9 games.
To work hard.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
We'll
Join us on the Football Ramble as we explore the ridiculous world of football. We bring in-depth analysis of the biggest moments, like Bruno Fernandes' one-eyed penalties.
It sounds like a Metallica song.
Yeah, it does.
But obviously, like, one eye open.
But if you have one eye closed, you know your perception. So imagine if you tried the dink and it just like went like 2 feet in front of him.
Yeah. Every weekday, we cover the good, the bad, and the Newcastle.
Although Shelby wasn't surprised either. He said the way they play isn't great.
And you couldn't fucking beat him, could you?
Could Shelby be the mole?
Didn't Bruce accuse the mole of treason?
To the Geordie Nation.
Yeah.
Putting the football world to rights.
If you want to put a message on a T-shirt under your shirt, slag it off your man.
Yeah.
That is an absolute minefield in the dressing room.
Don't worry, lads, I'll put it in another language. Do you know how many languages that man speaks?
With Roy. Yeah. That might wash with Roy.
We're here with the biggest stories from the sport we love, and we want you to get involved too. Search the Football Ramble on your favourite podcast player to listen now.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Let's move on to one of the other fixtures for the quarterfinal of the Champions League. In my view, this was the most eye-catching one. PSG versus Bayern ended, of course, with Bayern winning 1-0, but that didn't keep them in the Champions League at all. When I look at that fixture, I see it in the way that we've been talking about the arms race that you talked about a moment ago. PSG have got all the best players in that because Lewandowski wasn't in that match. David Alba, yeah, okay, fair enough, but not on the level. He's not on the level of Kylian Mbappe and Neymar on his day. And it felt like Neymar was getting a lot of service, didn't convert it as much, but he was an exciting player to watch. And Mbappe, just out of this world for this match. I don't think Bayern had much of a chance here, did they?
Well, they did create a lot of chances.
Yeah, of
and
course
I do have to say, I mean, if Lewandowski was there, it's probably a different story. But then equally, especially in the second leg, the amount of chances that PSG had. So, we're going to get on to the kind of the wider issues and all the kind of the political context of this game and these clubs in a bit. But from a purely football perspective and from that of the kind of players on the pitch, it did feel just kind of a classic European Cup tie between two good teams. Where when you actually break it down, it's actually hard to be too critical or even too praiseworthy. Basically, just ultimately, two good teams played each other and events happened.
Yeah.
I don't mean to be simplistic about it, but that was almost the nature of it. Like,
But it was tactically a very tricky proposition for Bayern because, I mean, they like to defend high up the pitch, and we saw in the first leg how that's a dangerous thing to do against Neymar. But now they didn't have a choice. They had to attack. Mm. And even with a slightly ropey-looking back four who have... I got annoyed with this. Let's not do other broadcasters down here, but on the commentary, you kept hearing, oh, it's unusual to see Bayern carved open like this. It's not usual at all.
Exactly.
They're really sloppy defensively. They have been all year, except in the Bundesliga, they can put four past anyone, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But they concede chances is what they do because they play very high up the pitch. They don't always have that intensive pressure on the ball.
Well, even going back to the 8-2, and I know like the final score rendered it ridiculous, but remember the first 20 minutes of that game, Barca cut through by three or four times.
Yeah.
And like, not that it could have gone the other way, but it could have been more uncomfortable for Bayern.
So
that was there then.
And I think Mbappe is possibly the single worst player on the planet for Bayern to come up against because he is such a kryptonite to the way they like to play football and the way they've been dominant for the last couple of years because it's really simplistic. But, you have a guy who's that fast and that good a finisher, you have him just hanging on the shoulder of the last defender when they push that high up. It's always going to cause them trouble. And you say they had a lot of chances, PSG. There were also a lot of situations where they were a couple of inches on the final ball away from having obvious chances as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah.
You kept thinking like PSG are going to score a few on the counter here. So it was very tense from that perspective, and it was a really enjoyable. It was a really enjoyable game, and we'll get to it further in the pod. I'm not sure it's a good development that it's ended up like this, but it is at least fun to watch when these sort of domineering super clubs, who are effectively not used to having to defend much in their domestic leagues, when they come up against each other, you get these sort of chaotic games. They're tremendously fun to watch,
but they are because one of the teams had an uphill battle because Bayern was already behind. Over the two fixtures, after the first leg, they're already behind. Mm. If, as Lars says there, because you have to score, because there's a lot of pressure on you to take the bull by the horns and take the game to PSG, you're going to leave yourself open. So if you've already got problems in defence, as they've got, and they've got Mbappe,
I couldn't
see how that was going to work for Bayern. They needed a different strategy here, and I'm not sure what it was.
I thought they got the balance right, to be fair, I have to say. I mean,
but it didn't work for them.
PSG's misses notwithstanding. But even to get into the position where the game was so brilliantly tense once they got that goal. And I mean, the weird thing about that goal as well, it felt against the run of play just because Neymar hit the bar twice. But in the spell before that, Bayern had been all over PSG. Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about the final pass being not quite right. I mean, I'm sure, again, if you want to do some serious video analysis and you go through the 90 minutes of that game and you stop it every time a Bayern winger has the ball in a really good position Sana and Coman to an extent as well, just getting into good positions and just not picking the right pass, not picking the right moment to release the ball. These sort of little things that end up deciding it. And I do think, like, to be fair to Bayern, they had 45 shots over the two legs. Usually, if you have 45 shots over two legs, you go through.
Yeah.
But especially when you usually have the best, you know, finish the best number nine probably still in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
But they didn't have that. They had Eric Maxim Choupo-Moting, who isn't some sort of joke player, but he's not Lewandowski.
Yeah. The one thing I have to say, I thought PSG's defensive trivet, especially Danilo Pereira, were absolutely brilliant. Yeah. And I mean, it's hard not to link that to the kind of resolve that Pochettino would be specifically trying to introduce to this team.
Yeah.
And they just feel a bit less feckless and self-indulgent.
Can you see the Pochettino effect?
I think it's still
from
a little
that match. Can you?
It's still a little bit hard given also, like, I don't think they play Pochettino football yet, which at Spurs would have been kind of like really high pressing. I mean, some of the best performances I saw of Pochettino Spurs are when they just wouldn't let opposition teams out of the 30 yards around their goal. Mm. I remember there's one game, they beat Watford 1-0, and afterwards, Kike Sanchez-Flores said, like, he was like playing against, I think he's referred to them as animals or something like that.
Yeah.
But like, it was basically a 1-0 that was actually a 5-0.
Yeah.
So we haven't seen that yet, but I think we are beginning to see, in Europe anyway, a bit more of that kind of resolve that you would more associate with Pochettino.
I do wonder if it's possible to play like that when you have Mbappe and Neymar.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't want them spending all their energy herring around. You probably can't convince them to do it either. Mm. So you're going to have to do it a little bit differently.
Yeah.
I was very impressed with Danilo. And I think one of the things I noticed, when a team spends as much time in the final third as Bayern does, and as much time in the box as Bayern does, you have to be really careful not to concede penalties. Like, it's so you got to sort. There were so many interventions from Danilo where I thought he did really well just not to foul anyone, because you can so easily go down that route. One thing I think was an issue for Bayern and has been an issue for Bayern all year is the transfer window they probably had to have for financial reasons, but the fact that they ended up going so cut rate with their squad players, you know, buying your Buna Sars and your Mark Rocca and Choupo-Moting and these guys, I think it's maybe not what Hansi Flick wanted. And they're a very thin squad. Like, their first 11 is very strong. They have a couple of good backups, but a couple of injuries and the drop off in quality is quite dramatic.
Yeah,
and if they had a better backup option at centre forward, I think not.
But that's almost a Harry Kane problem as well. Now, when you have one number nine to play so often, and because it's a fixed number nine, you don't have the same variability up front, that it's just harder to get a second option.
And I think the thing that was bad luck for them is that, I mean, Serge Gnabry has been playing as a centre forward for Germany recently, but then he was unavailable as well for this one. So one of the wingers who could have done it wasn't there.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought in Germany there, because of course they'll be in the Euros as well. And I wonder to what extent this defeat by PSG from Germany's Premier team, Bayern Munich, will have an impact there on who goes to the Euros. And obviously, we're also talking now about Bayern Munich concentrating on the Bundesliga. That's the only way they're going to save their season, really, I think.
And it's pretty much confirmed, isn't it?
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, they're going to have a pretty weird collapse for it to not be. And I also think, obviously, a lot of, maybe if they'd have won, Hansi Flick might have felt, okay, I have stronger cards now and it might be possible for me to get the club to bend to me rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
But the fact they've gone out now and he has a long-standing, you know, disagreements with the sporting director, Hasan Salihamidžić, I think it's very hard to imagine him continuing there. And the very, very obvious move is that he'll go and take over Germany after the Euros.
Cavi Moreno bene, Shevchenko nello spazio, va via Shevchenko, accelera, salta tutti Shevchenko, cerca la conclusione, Andrei! Shevchenko!
Now, gentlemen, you're going to have to, you know, an old-timer like me, you're going to have to explain the grammar of a verb that I've never come across. What is it to sports wash?
Well, essentially, it's using sport, in this case football, or in this case two specific clubs, to, I suppose, make the image of your country or your state or your emirate more palatable. And it's about integrating into the West, being able to do business in the West without uncomfortable questions being asked, or to the same degree, about your human rights record. And the purchases of Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain have worked spectacularly, with that never more proved by this week. I mean, Lars referenced it there about how fun the Paris Saint-Germain game was to watch, and it was something I did feel guilty almost watching the game. It was something that occurred to me. Basically, am I being sports washed here? I mean, given the purpose of these purchases, how often did you think about, you know, human rights issues in Abu Dhabi or Qatar? As well, it feels like the Qatar one is more relevant because of the nature of that game.
And also because that's where the World Cup is going to be in a couple of years' time.
Yeah, so I find this a challenging discussion to have, because we very much live in a sort of northern European media bubble.
Yeah,
where the reporting that we read on these issues might be different to the things they put emphasis on in different parts of the world. I definitely think, certainly where I'm from in Norway, if the object of getting the World Cup to Qatar, for instance, was to launder their image, that has massively backfired, because there's been so much emphasis on wrongdoing. And I suspect if you polled people in my home country, sort of who's the worst sort of human rights abusers in the Gulf, a lot of them would say Qatar, because there's been so much focus on it, which I think if you ask human rights experts is not correct.
Some people would say
Saudi Arabia.
Exactly right.
This week in the news, the revelation that the Saudi strongman, if you like, the most controversial, Mohammed bin Salman, had been in some kind of consultation with the British government over buying Newcastle, which would have, I imagine, fallen into the,
Sports washing exercise. That story by Craig Hope in the Mail, it basically kind of just completely undercut the ludicrous notion that PIF, the Public Investment Fund, that we're going to buy 80% of Newcastle, they were some way separate from the Saudi state, which is always ridiculous. It completely undercuts a lot of debates for the takeover. But yeah, what they were doing, what Saudi Arabia wanted to do was basically, it was pursuing the Abu Dhabi model with Manchester City and Qatari model with PSG. But I think you're right, Lars, and that we can get confused by the bull. But that's also why I think sports washing really works spectacularly. Because our perception, but we're in a media bubble. We've been working on these issues, or reading a lot about these issues. Mm. And it still represents a very, very narrow band of people invested in football who are anyway, you know, invested in these issues. A lot of people just don't care. It doesn't permeate. I mean, when Manchester City are running away with the champion, or even in the TV discussions around these games, how often does this come up? I do think it's a bit of a dereliction of duty for media to not discuss this. What is the purpose of this? Especially given, I mean, I'm embarking on a bit of a rant here, but what we're actually seeing right now, and why this Manchester City Paris Saint-Germain semi-final is so significant and so symbolic, it's almost like the under the radar takeover of football. And you know, we've been discussing transfers and all that, and I've said this on the show before, but one of the main motivations behind the Neymar signing was not just signing a great player from a rival. It was also because Paris Saint-Germain's Qatari owners knew that if they drove up football fees and wages to a certain point, as financial people have said to me, short squeezing the market, they knew only a handful of clubs could compete. That was Manchester City, who are Abu Dhabi owned, Manchester United, Chelsea, and maybe one or two others, or whoever's eventually bought by Saudi Arabia. So what you have here is basically the takeover of the top end of football by some of the most questionable states in the world for purposes that are not to do with the benefit of the game and are going to have a huge influence on the game. And we're already seeing it in France with Paris Saint-Germain's dominance. It's possible we could have Manchester City doing similar in England, especially if they win a quadruple this season to follow from the treble 2 years ago. And that's why there's a guilt almost watching these games and a question of how often we should be thinking about these issues.
And interestingly, if the states in question were different, for example, if the Chinese had taken over an English club or a French club, a European club, in the way that the Abu Dhabians and the Qatarians have, I'm not sure whether the governments would stand back and just allow. For example, the comment that Miguel made a moment or two ago about the separation of people who are buying Newcastle from the state itself.
Yeah.
The British government would have none of that in terms of China.
I think they would.
Like, you reckon?
Yeah. I mean, there is. And also, if China bought a club, well, I think we'd have exactly the same discussions. You could extend that to the USA, given some, but ultimately the USA aren't buying clubs for sports washing, and some of the owners aren't linked.
They're
to the state.
They're buying it for profit.
The owners aren't linked to the state in the same way, even though they're. I mean, like the Glazers are basically Trump supporters, but
you can have your political affiliation. But that's different from this.
As someone in human rights put to me, the Glazers aren't bombing Yemen. but there isn't. I mean, and this comes up a lot, that we are in a world where, you know, just in the network of politics, economy, society means, you know, the influence of states with hugely questionable human rights records, it's inescapable. But you can still draw a line with football, precisely because football clubs are supposed to be, you can set regulations in place to prevent this. And precisely because football club, it's not just business. Football clubs have a community role. That's their primary role. They're social institutions. And yet what has actually happened is they've just been allowed, there's been a takeover of the game, basically facilitated. And it is hugely frustrating.
Well, I mean, Harry Redknapp famously once said that, you know, the fans don't care. I mean, as long as the owner puts money in, you know, if the owner was Saddam Hussein, they'd be chanting "There's only one Saddam Hussein," he said once, and he's completely right.
I'm not sure if they'd be chanting that, but he does have a point in the affiliation. I'm genuinely not sure they'd be chanting that, but the affiliation.
Well, I mean, really, like, look at what happens at Manchester City. Look at what happens at Manchester City, and look at the response. Anytime anyone brings up human rights, it's actually remarkable. It's more specific. It's Sheikh Mansour, and with Manchester City, there's a bit double thing that it's not the state that owns it. It's Sheikh Mansour, and he's a private investor. Well, no, he's just an extension of that. He's part of the royal family.
This might not be a good comparison, but White Man in Hammersmith Palais, The Clash, crucial line in that, if Adolf Hitler drew up today, they'd send a limousine anyway. I'm not saying it's connected, I'm just telling you. But the fans' association with the club is with the club, not with the owner. It's with the club, those people who wear the jersey, the players that go on the pitch for the 90 minutes. So I can understand that fans not necessarily turn a blind eye, but that the spectacle of what's happening in Abu Dhabi or Qatar doesn't permeate into the fans' experience when they watch the team on the terraces.
But it's hard to separate it when the club has, I mean, the players are there because of the club's financial pulling power. That's the main reason they're at any given club. That's the same for City as it is for Leighton Orient. You know, it's a living and you go there to earn money. And if that money is there because the club is being used to market a very questionable regime, how can you not ask the question? How can you separate that? It's very difficult.
But this is also, it's the insidious nature of sports washing. And what it's actually doing is precisely banking on fans' emotional investment to create all this. And I do have a lot of sympathy for fans. And there are plenty of fans who wrestle with it. But I think, especially when you've grown up with a club, it is basically impossible to psychologically disentangle yourself from your connection. So I do have a lot of sympathy from that regard. But that still shouldn't extend to defense of what the owners are, especially not when, as soon as the owners do something you don't like, fans will take up. I mean, you only have to look at the history of Manchester City with Peter Swales or United with the Glazers. The owners aren't the club, right? They currently own it in a very literal sense, but owners are still only ever passing through. They aren't the identity of the club. They aren't the core of the club.
What about what difference it makes to the actual game? Because all this money has come in from wherever to support teams like PSG and Man City, the teams at the top of the European game in any case. Has it made a positive? And I know we're not trying to sort of detach the politics from the game. But if you look at just the game last year, has it made a positive... Sorry, Miguel.
It's not a positive, because what we're seeing is actually the increased financial disparity of football. That is a very bad thing. People go on about lifting the level. How can it lift the level from anyone else if you can't financially compete?
And also, you're not like inventing new players by pouring more money into it. The players are the same. The player base are the same. Kylian Mbappe would still have been an amazing player if he wasn't at a Qatari-owned PSG. He would just be at a different football club.
The only issue is that just by, and Ger Gilroy in Ireland made a news talk made a good point about this. When you are bringing so many stars together and bringing the best staff because you can afford them, you will just by definition reach a higher level of football. But while that is good to watch, it's not necessarily good for the game, because I mean, what the higher level of football does is just win everything, and it's a product of kind of financial dominance and supercharged finances rather than kind of the same sort of sporting construction over time.
It's not going away though. This ain't going away.
But this is the future.
Exactly. This is a question. No, absolutely. This is the question. Is this the future of football, Lars? Is this the way it will be? Will there be more states looking to sports wash? And if not sports wash, just invest in football.
It could be, because it's hard to regulate because it's a sort of football is played in different countries. Like one country could go and put in very, very stringent rules for who's allowed to put money into the game. That money will just go somewhere else, and which is why stuff like a wage cap is incredibly hard to implement in any sort of effective way, because it goes across different countries. And I don't know. I mean, football in general as a sport has a problem where it's addicted to money and it has no culture for asking questions about where that money's coming from. It's always been that way. And I don't see how it's going to stop being that way anytime soon. And it presents a huge dilemma for fans and people like ourselves who love the game and who want to watch the best players for sporting reasons, because it's the game we've grown up following and it's what our lives revolves around. But it's almost impossible to completely extricate it from the issues off the pitch.
So, let's talk about your games of the week. And there are some crackers to contend with, not least, Miguel, the Copa del Rey, which is taking place this weekend, final.
That's what I'm going with, which obviously has the extra dimension because Bilbao just lost the 2020 Cup last week. So
we go again.
Yeah, we go again, lads. So yeah, that's what I'm going. But of course, it's up against Barcelona, who after what had been one of the most trying years in their recent history, now have the chance of a domestic double.
Don't know if they'll keep Messi there in the summer, but yeah, that's a good one to watch. What about you, Lars?
Listen, there are two I want to mention. First of all, Atalanta versus Juventus is really interesting because Atalanta are on good form. Juventus are in a position now where they'll probably be fine, but they're not completely in the clear in terms of making the Champions League next year. Napoli are fifth, just a couple of points behind them. Juventus are third at the moment. Atalanta are one of the teams who are definitely capable of taking points off of Juventus, so that's very exciting. But I have to say, Napoli-Inter Sunday night, just because we're very, very close now to being able to say that Inter are going to win the league, and they are almost certainly going to win the league, and Conte have made them less crazy, and it's not Pazza Inter anymore, and... But if there is going to be a collapse, which you always think is a possibility with Inter, it's kind of hard to shake these sort of prejudices. If there's going to be a collapse, it's going to have to start now because they're running out of difficult opponents this season. So Napoli-Inter Sunday night. If Inter don't lose that one, we can almost crown them champions, I think. Mm. I think that is the point where you think that it's not going to go wrong for them. It is going to happen. It's the last sort of major hurdle, I think, in the league, to be fair, in terms of them getting all the way. So, yeah, Napoli-Inter is the one for me.
I do love when you suggest games of the week that have a lot of jeopardy about them. Oh, I love that. Gentlemen, thank you.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.